Okay, so now we are approaching the end of this gradual training, and one of the things that happens at this point is, of course, the importance of giving rise to the joy and the happiness in your meditation so that it can take you all the way into samadhi. There's no real samadhi without that joy and happiness. Pitisukha is one of those important qualities that you have to develop on this part. At this point, so this is shows you one way in which this happens. This next sutta is called the Mahanama Sutta. Mahanama was one of the cousins of the Buddha, and he was supposed to be a stream enter, so he was very, very well practiced and had his act together. So this is one of the ways in which to give rise to this joy on the path. Often the joy just comes about because you practice in the right way, you're watching the breath, you're doing the metta meditation, whatever it is, and joy tends to happen as a consequence of that, because the defilements disappear and then the joy comes. But there are also more like deliberate strategies, if you like, to give rise to joy, and this is these are some of those ways that are recommended by the Buddha. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavatthu in the banyan tree park. Then Mahanama the Sakyan approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to the Blessed One. So here we are at Kapilavatthu. Kapilavatthu is pretty much the hometown of the Buddha, and this is the capital of the Sakyan Republic. Of course, that's where the Buddha came from originally. And Kapilavatthu has pretty much been discovered also in the by archaeologists in the north of India. And there was a pile of seals found in the place, and all those seals had the stamp Kapilavatthu on them. So it is fairly certain that we know where Kapilavatthu is situated. One of the interesting things about Kapilavatthu is one of the few sites where it looks like the remnants of the Buddha were left undisturbed for a long, long period of time. Most of those other sites, they were emptied out, and the relics and the bones, whatever was there, was taken out and was divided around India. But Kapilavatthu seems to have been one of the few places where it was not taken out. These are the original stupas where the bones were put into stupas soon after the passing away of the Buddha. And the reason for that is because at Kapilavatthu there was a war which happened soon after Buddha passed away. And it seems like the Sakyans were mostly slaughtered in that war. So it probably went back to the jungle, and that stupa was kind of forgotten about. Until an Englishman who was a landowner in that area, English people always kind of keen archaeologists, so he saw this mound, he wondered, why is there a mound on my property? And he started digging into this mound, right? Curiosity got to him. And then as he dug in, they found this ancient stone casket inside, and inscribed on that casket in ancient characters, it talked like Ashokan characters from the time of Ashoka. It was inscribed, "These are the relics of the Lord Buddha," or something like that, "owned by so and so," or whatever. That was actually found in the ground there. So if ever you want to see some real Buddha relics, lots of Buddha relics going around, and the it's very uncertain where those Buddha relics often come from, right? Very unreliable, but these ones are probably some of the most reliable Buddha relics anywhere. And they are now kept in Delhi. So you've got to go all the way to India to see them. But they are in a museum in Delhi, a very nice museum apparently. I haven't even seen them myself, but a very beautiful museum in Delhi here. That's where they are kept. So that's the Kapilavatthu and the banyan tree park. So Mahanama comes to the Buddha, and then he says, "Bhante, how does a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching often dwell?" Who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching means that he is a stream enterer, a sotapanna. That's kind of the meaning of that, because that's when you understand the teachings. So this teaching is given specifically to a stream enterer, but elsewhere a very similar teaching is also given to ordinary people who are not stream enterers. So it is really valuable for everyone here. Mahanama, a noble disciple who has arrived at the fruit and understood the teaching, often dwells in this way. Here, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Tathagata thus: the Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly awakened, accomplished in insight and conduct, the Happy One, the One who knows the world, the unsurpassed trainer of tameable people, teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed. So we have already looked at this formula before, and this is the standard formula throughout the suttas, how the Buddha is described, and how the Buddha recommends that we should recall someone who is fully awakened. These are the qualities of a person who is fully awakened. So again, it's nice to think about those qualities a little bit. And when you think about that, and you think that this is your teacher, this is the person who is guiding us, it can become very powerful if you get into that. I'm not going to go through it again. But what happens when you do that is when a noble disciple recollects the Tathagata, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by desire, by ill will, and by confusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, Ujjugata, based on the Tathagata. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. So this is how it's supposed to work, right? When you recall the Tathagata, that what you are really recalling is spiritual qualities. You are rejoicing in spiritual qualities, qualities that have nothing to do with defilements and all these kind of things, but qualities that have all to do with the inner joy, the inner happiness, the ending of all the defilements and all of these kind of things, the ending of suffering itself. And because you are thinking about these spiritual qualities, all the worldly things tend to disappear and go out of the window at that particular time. So that is really what is going on here. And that is why it says his mind is not obsessed by these defilements. Yeah, at that point, because your mind is moving in the exact opposite direction of those defilements. When you think about the Buddha, the Dhamma is right there in the background. So you are rejoicing in the Dhamma, which is the exact opposite of rejoicing in defilements or being defiled. So, and because you are not obsessed by the defilements, your mind is called straight. It's straight, you see clearly. And the opposite of that is the crooked mind. They talk about the crooked mind elsewhere. And the crooked mind is the one that is defiled with all kinds of defilements. So you gain the straightness. In other words, this is a degree of vipassana already. Yeah, because you're seeing things more clearly. This is a certain degree of vipassana that arises already at this point, because you see clearly. And it is straight. When the mind is straight, it gains inspiration in the meaning. This is the Atta Veda in Pali. And the Veda, word Veda, means both feeling, you feel something, you feel a sense of, wow, this is great, and also it's about knowledge and understanding that this is something special. So it's a mixture of feeling and knowledge. And there's again two things that go together in Buddhism. If you have real insight, it makes you feel happy. Feeling and knowledge always goes together. True insight gives rise to lightness, happiness, and all these things, which is wonderful. It doesn't. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so good. So what you are gaining that inspiration in is, he says here, in the meaning, right? So this idea of knowledge and feeling together, that is like inspiration. That's what is translated it as here. The Pali word is Veda. So that combination of knowledge and feeling positive about it is what he has called inspiration. Which kind of makes sense. Inspiration in English means like, if you're inspired, it means you have energy, you have a sense of, you know, positive mind state or whatever. But it also often has a connotation of being something you understand. You are inspired by something because you understand it, that sort of thing. And that inspiration in the meaning. So what is the meaning? The Atta in Pali. And the meaning means like the goal of the practice, the purpose, what we are aiming for. So when you understand the Atta, when you're inspired by the Atta, it means that you're inspired because you understand that this is a really worthwhile practice. It is moving towards a goal that is very elevated and very uh, and And you know, the highest insight, the ending of all suffering, the highest happiness. It's astonishing that this is even available in the world. And when you remember that, oh, it gives you a sense of uplift and inspiration as a consequence. So there's the idea of meaning here. It means the meaning in the sense of understanding the goal of these things. And then you get also inspiration in the Dhamma. The Dhamma here means the teaching, because the teaching is what drives you, gives you access to that meaning or access to that goal on the path. And then you gain the joy connected with the Dhamma. And this is where things really start out. This is the Pamujja. And so here the joy arises because of that inspiration, the joy comes up. So the idea here is just that as the defilements, as you think about the Dhamma, the defilements go, and when the defilements go, joy comes in its place. This is what this is about. And then you are basically in business. Then you have kind of, you're at the very, you have made the foundation for all the good qualities to arise. So that's what happens next then, all these good qualities arising here. When his joyful rapture arises, for one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. You remember that sequence? Yeah? So this is the interesting thing. You read the suttas and you recognize the things, yeah? And you see them again and again in slightly different contexts, in slightly different ways. And this is what is so beautiful about them. And after a while, you start to see how it all fits together very nicely. Yeah? So this is actually very similar to the second sutta we had looked at on the very first or the second day, or whatever it was, which shows you the psychology of meditation, how you experience meditation in the first person when it works properly. This is what you're seeing there. And here you see another way of looking at that, how you give rise to that sequence, give rise to that meditation by thinking about the Buddha in the right way. So this is how it works. You give rise to that joy, and then as you do that, you can either continue to reflect on the Buddha and it give rise to more joy, or at some stage here you can move on to your meditation object, like the breath, for example, or something like that. And you can experiment a little bit with that to see what works out. So the idea is to kind of bring these things together, the meditation object together with the joy, and all of this kind of, when this kind of gets the right quantities of each one, so to speak, then it becomes like dynamite, and it kind of takes you all the way to samadhi and all these profound blisses on the Buddhist path. So there you are. So all of these things happen as a consequence, and then your mind becomes stilled. And when the mind is stilled, when you attain samadhi, this is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population. Who dwells unafflicted amidst an afflicted population. As the one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Buddha. So you are in balance, right? This is this idea of having this even mind during the day, a mind which doesn't jump around and go up and down according to your defilements and all these things, but you have this evenness of mind. You dwell in balance. Most people, most of the time, are kind of out of balance. Either they are attracted to something, or they are averse, or they are angry, or they have desire, and the mind is never really even. And that even mind is a very pleasant mind. There's a feeling that you're standing back a little bit from the world. You have a sense of perspective, you have a sense of being in charge of yourself. We had the idea of the sat indriya. The indriya is the faculty of mindfulness. Samad indriya as well. These are the things that they're called faculties because they are powers. These are things that allow you to be in charge of your own mind, in charge of your own actions, and have a feeling of being in control of yourself. You're not just kind of all over the place. And you are unafflicted, right? It's interesting because affliction, obviously, you haven't overcome all suffering yet, but you have overcome a large amount of suffering here. And that's why you're called unafflicted already at this stage. If you're able to attain all of these happinesses, including samadhi, already you are almost getting very close already to the end of the Buddhist path at this point. So because of that, you are unafflicted already. In the middle of an afflicted population here. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, you develop the recollection of the Buddha. So that is number one, recollection of the Buddha. And again, these things are not easy to do. Don't expect that this is going to work out very easily. You just sit down and you bliss out because you remember the Buddha. That would be great if it was that simple, but it isn't. And the reason it isn't so easy is because we haven't fully appreciated what the Dhamma is all about. The more you understand the Dhamma, where these teachings are heading, what they are about, the kind of supreme happiness that they give rise to, the ending of all problems, the more you get that, the more kind of amazed you are that these things even exist in the world. And think, wow, isn't it astonishing that these teachings are available? They are available for me to use here and now. And then you start to appreciate the Buddha who taught these things, who has attained that goal already. And when all that kind of comes together, that is when you feel a sense of joy, when you understand what is going on. So let's have a look at the next one. The next one is precisely about the Dhamma. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about that. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple, recollects the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise. So this is how the Buddha says we should recall the Dhamma, right? So these are the qualities of the Dhamma that makes the Dhamma special. So let's have a quick look at these ones. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo. Svakato literally means well expounded. That's exactly what it means. The idea behind that is, again, probably this idea that when the Buddha speaks, he's very careful with the way he uses language. He says things in a way whereby it can last for a long time in the future. So, which means that when we read the Buddha word, you're careful with how you read it. Every word matters, and the whole thing is very nicely structured, and you remember that. So you don't take anything, nothing in there is kind of haphazard or random, anything like that. Structured, every word has a meaning, etc. That is already very, very nice. So this means that we have a special, when you read the suttas, you are especially careful about that. Then we have the idea of sandittika, directly visible, it says here. Sandittika in the suttas has two meanings in a sense. And one meaning, it is when it is used in opposition to samparayika. Samparayika means that has to do with future lives or your next life. So sandittika is this idea that it relates to this life, this existence. This is one of those things that makes the Buddhist teachings, again, quite special, that everything in Buddhism is attainable in this life. Yeah, everything is experienceable right here in this life. Don't have to wait to get it confirmed after you die. If it is after you die and you got it wrong, it's tough luck, right? But but in Buddhism, it isn't like that. You actually get a chance to see everything here and now. Which is great. So when we talk about Nibbana, for example, in Buddhism, many people think that Nibbana is kind of what happens after the Arahant dies or something like that. But no, Nibbana is actually the ending of all the defilements in this life. So when you end the defilements and your mind is free of that, that state itself is called Nibbana in Buddhism. Often people think Nibbana means a state, it means some kind of meditation experience. But actually, it just means that freedom from defilements, that's all it really means. So this is the first thing that sandittika means. Everything is available in this life. But the second thing that means, which in many ways is even more interesting, and that is it refers to the idea that you can actually experience the Dhamma if you practice in the right way, right here and right now, in this very moment. And the Buddha explains that in the suttas. He says that if you think in the right way, right here and now, and you direct your mind with yoniso manasikara, you will experience the benefit in this moment, right? In this very moment, if you use yoniso manasikara, you will experience the benefit of that. You will experience an increase in the good states and a decline in the bad ones. You will experience joy. You will experience gladness. It happens straight away. Often we are not able to use yoniso manasikara all the time, but sometimes you can see it happening inside of yourself. You're able to overcome some negative state. You're able to overcome something by thinking wisely. And suddenly that negativity vanishes, and in its place comes a very beautiful state instead. And it makes you feel happy. So notice that, and that is what the Buddha means. It is available right here, right now, if we do it in the right way. this is one of those things, and it tells you something about whether you are heading in the right direction or not. And there was a nice sutta that, talks about this, and a sutta which I often found cryptic in the beginning. I didn't really understand what was going on until eventually it became clear, because actually it was quite obvious what was going on. And this is a sutta found in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Devata Sanyutta. Sorry, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, Devata Sanyutta. And number 20, it's called the Samiddhi Sutta. And I often read it out on these retreats, but not this time. And this is Samiddhi. Samiddhi goes to, he's staying in Rajagaha, the capital of the Magadhan state at that time. And in Rajagaha, as I was saying the other day, there are these hot springs. And the monks would go there to bathe. And he went there to bathe in the hot springs. And after he had bathed, he came out. He was kind of drying himself. And then as he was drying himself, this devata, this god, comes down to him. And this god says to him, listen, you are a young man, right? You are young, you can still enjoy yourself, you can go back into the world, find a girlfriend. She doesn't say that, but that's kind of the implication, right? Find a girlfriend, enjoy the sensual pleasures of all types. What are you wasting your life being a monk? This is madness. You are trying to seek something in the future, nibbana, when all of these pleasures are available right here and now. Why seek for this kind of thing in the way in the future when all the pleasures in the world are available right here and now to you? And Samiddhi is not quite sure, right? So he says, he replies, well, actually, it's the other way around. He says, the Dhamma is here and now. The Dhamma is available here and now. Whereas the sensual pleasures, they are the ones that actually are in the future. And the Devata, the God says, what do you mean? I don't understand what you're talking about. And I remember I was giving a talk somewhere overseas a couple of years ago, and I was talking about this sutta. And there was a large audience there, and there was a young man in the front. So I asked the audience, what do you think? Do you think the devata is right? Or is the monk right? Who is right in this case? And there was this cheeky young man on the front bench. Oh, the devata is right. The devata is right in this case. It was very funny. There was 200 people bursting out laughing when that happened. So we know instinctively that the devata is wrong, but why is it that the devata is wrong? What is going on here? And that is precisely what I was talking about now, that if you practice rightly in this moment, you gain the joy of the Dhamma, and that happens in the present moment, because there's no craving, there's no desire associated with that. The joy and happiness of the Dhamma happens in the here and now. It happens with mindfulness, it happens with the presence of mind. It is not something that has to do with the future. So although Nibbana itself or jhanas may be in the future, you actually gain that happiness of the Dhamma right here and now, if you do things in the right way. But on the other hand, of course, the sensual desires, even though in one sense they are kind of available in one way, they are always associated with craving. Yeah, always. It's very rare that there is no craving there when you indulge in sensual pleasures. And even if there's a short time when you're kind of reasonably happy, usually there's actually craving there even while you are enjoying those things. And then as soon as it's finished, the mind turns to something else. And so it goes on and on and on forever. So because it's craving, it's about the future. Desire and craving is always about the future somewhere. You're moving to something else, moving to satisfaction somewhere just over the horizon, never actually getting there. And this is the problem with sensual desire. It's almost like a lie. You think it is here and now, but actually it is never really here and now. It's always in the future. That's a very nice way of thinking about the Dhamma and this distinction between the Dhamma happiness and the ordinary happiness of the world. So that is Sandittika. And then we have Akalika. So this is Venerable Akalika's name. Here it says immediate, which is not a bad translation. Sometimes it is called timeless, which is not quite right, but immediate is not too bad. And the idea again is that it is a synonym for directly visible or visible here and now in this life, and also straight away if you do it in the right way. So just a synonym for that, really. Inviting one to come and see. This is ehipasiko. Ehipasiko, and that's also a very similar idea. Again, come and see for yourself. Come and experience it right here and now. And check it out, right? Challenging you to kind of see if the Dhamma is right or not. So again, a similar kind of idea there. Then we have opanaika. Opanaika means something like it says here, applicable, but it means worthy. It means more like worthy of application, right? It is worthy of being applied. Why? Well, it's worthy of being applied because it leads to all those things we want. Yeah, we apply ourselves to all kinds of stuff in the world which doesn't really lead anywhere. Now, here is the thing which is worthy of the highest application because it gives the highest results. That is really what opanaika is about. This word is translated in many different ways, like leading onwards and that kind of stuff. But worthy of application, I think, is quite an inspiring way of translating that. This Dhamma is really worthy of sitting down, meditating, applying our minds, because this is going to give some real results in our life, something really worthwhile. And then lastly, to be personally experienced by the wise. So you have to have a little bit of wisdom. And this is kind of the paradox on this path. You have to start off with a little bit of wisdom. Otherwise, you're not going to go anywhere. But of course, there is no point in being kind of conceited about wisdom if one is practicing in the right way, because that wisdom itself comes just from all kind of causes and conditions coming together in the present moment. It's just one of those things that happen. And when you understand that, then you don't become kind of too conceited about whatever wisdom you may have already. So that is the Dhamma. Yeah, this is how the Buddha says we should talk about the Dhamma. Again, you need some insight into this to really feel inspired by this. But when you feel inspired, then exactly the same thing happens as happened with the previous one. When a noble disciple recollects the Dhamma on that occasion, his mind is not obsessed by desire, ill will, and confusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight, based on the Dhamma. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, the Atta Veda. In other words, the inspiration in the goal of the path, where we're all heading here. Gains inspiration in the Dhamma, in the teaching. Gains joy connected with the teaching. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population. Who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of the Dhamma. Okay, so that is the first two parts of the Triple Gem, and now we come to the third part, the Sangha itself. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciple is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Remember, these things are the things that you chant very often in Buddhism. We kind of recite this thing. This is the Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Udripatipanno, etc. Yeah, this is what this one is. So again, these are the kind of very standard things that we do. Very often in Buddhism, we recite things that are not actually from the suttas, that are much later on, that were invented by all kinds of people throughout the ages. But these are some of the original chants, original recitations that go all the way back to the Buddha. So these are the most interesting ones, because these are recommended by the Buddha himself. All the other stuff can be nice, but it doesn't have the same power as these things. So the Blessed One's disciple, they are practicing the good way. Supatipanno. And the point is that once you become a stream enter, you internalize the path of the Noble Eightfold Path. You know what that path is. And that is why you're practicing the good way. The rest of us, all those people who are not Aryans, noble ones, We're not practicing the good way yet, right? We are kind of fumbling around in the dark a little bit. We're given the teachings. Sometimes we succeed. Sometimes we don't quite succeed because we don't know what the path is. We don't know when our mind is in the right state. We don't know what is going on. And this is one of the problems of not being an Arya. It's only the Aryans who practice this path 100% because they have internalized it. So for the rest of us, we try to kind of approximate to that, get as close as we possibly can. And that is what we are, what kind of our purpose is. But these Aryans, they are fully on the path. So that's why they also practice in the straight way, the Ujju Patipanna. Ujju means straight. There's no kind of crookedness in the way they practice. They're practicing the true way, Nyaya Patipanno. Nyaya is a word that in the early Dhamma refers to dependent origination. It refers to Paticca-samuppada. This is what this is about. So they are practicing in accordance with dependent origination. So what does that mean? What that means is that dependent origination, it starts with avidya, right? Avidya, paccaya, sankhara. In other words, not ignorance, delusion gives rise to this willed activities of body and mind, and then it goes all the way through the 12 links, all the way to dukkha on the other end. So delusion gives rise to dukkha. That's what dependent origination is about. But then dependent origination also has a cessation mode. So when you eliminate avidya, when you eliminate delusion at the bottom, then each step through that whole thing is also eliminated until you eliminate suffering itself. Now, if you are a stream enter, if you are a noble disciple, you have that insight into the teachings. So you are working on that elimination process, the Nirodha process, the cessation process. You're working on that, gradually eliminating things more and more and more until it's all gone. Whereas the rest of us, we are kind of sometimes eliminating, sometimes we are adding a bit of delusion because we don't really know. It's only when you become a stream enter that you understand exactly what the problem is. So this is again the idea of the noble ones. They are actually practicing dependent arising or dependent cessation, if you like, directly through what they are doing at any moment in time, because they are carrying the noble path with them in their psyche, so to speak. They're practicing the proper way, same thing again, right? The real way, the way that is appropriate. So then we have this four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. That may sound a little bit cryptic to some of you, what that is all about. And what this is all about is just that it's just a way of classifying the noble ones into different categories. So you are classified according to whether you are a stream winner, whether you are a once return, a non-return, or arahant. That's four categories. Now there's two within each one. One is the one which is on the path to realizing that. Another one who actually has realized it. That's how we get four pairs and eight individuals. And maybe very briefly, just comment on that as well, is that in the later Buddhist literature, they say that that individual, the one who is on the path before you actually realize it, they say that that person is on the path. He's only there for one mind moment, and then he becomes you're on the path to stream entry for one mind moment. The next mind moment, you become a stream entry. That's what it says in later literature. But here it talks about eight individuals, right? And that they are worthy of offerings. So if you're only going to be on the path for one mind moment, you have to offer very quickly. Yeah. Oh, quick. One mind moment is so short. It's only 1 billionth of a second. Quick, quick, quick. Okay. I made it. So it is a bit absurd. And the reality is that sometimes there is a bit of tension between the way things are explained in the suttas and the way it is explained in later commentaries. And it's worthwhile being aware of that, because sometimes these things have practical implications. And you know, if you're going to look at your progress, it's good to know about all the stages. Otherwise, you might get confused of what is going on here. So that is the four pairs of persons, the eight type of individuals. These are the noble beings in the world, right? These are the people who are practicing properly. And this is the Sangha. This is the real Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples. The rest of us, we're kind of semi-disciples. We're trying kind of desperately to get there, but we're having a bit of a hard time because we are partially blind. But these ones are the ones that actually see. So once you see, you are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation. Why is that? Because you have the key to unlock all the happiness that is available in the universe. You know what that key is. You know the path. You're able to teach people the highest teaching that is available to humanity. Yeah, and if you are the highest kind of teacher, the Buddha on top, but all the Aryans have a similar kind of insight. If you're the highest kind of teacher, and you can give people the highest thing, you are worthy in return of all of these things. You respect people who have the ability to give you the highest. And this is what it's all about. So we respect any teacher. These are the best kind of teachers. So remember that. This is a beautiful thing to keep in mind. Of course, we don't really know who the Aryans in the world are. And because we don't know that, what we do, and this is what the Buddha recommends, if you want to give a gift to the Sangha, right? You want to support the Sangha in a certain way, you give it to the Sangha as a whole. You don't give it to individuals. Individuals is uncertain. Give to the Sangha as a whole. That will include the Aryans. And then you have the right kind of attitude when you give something. It's also a very broad mindset when you give to the whole Sangha, right? There are thousands of monastics out there, both male and female, practicing this path. What a wonderful thing it is when you kind of give to all of those at the same time. May anyone of that Sangha enjoy, this gift that I'm giving, whatever that is. That is the right way of giving an offering to the Sangha according to the Buddha. And because it is the unsurpassed field of merit for the world, precisely because they are the highest kind of teachers that are available. So that is the Sangha. And I sometimes like to think about some of the people who I consider the Aryans in this world and how they practice and how they do things. And often it's very inspiring to think about that. Some of the people who I have seen over the years and in different countries and different people. Some of those stories I was telling you about Ajahn Ganha the other day. He is one of these people where you feel there's something very... It's very hard to know exactly where they're at, what's going on with them, but you get this feeling there's something very powerful and very special about some of these people. And Ajahn Ganha, I'm sure you probably most of you may have heard this story before, but he has a famous story of... when he was wandering around in Thailand in the early years before all the forests were cut down in Thailand, right? And 30, 40 years ago, there was still quite a lot of forest left also in the northeast. Northeast is the Isan of Thailand. And they would wander around and go from jungle to jungle. And then one day they arrived at this village, Ajahn Ganha and all his monks. And they said to the headman of that village, they said, well, can we stay in the forest here and come out for Pindabat to collect alms food tomorrow morning? And the headman said, of course, we will be honored to have you stay here, so please stay here. So they go into the forest and they sit down. This is getting kind of towards the evening, and they sit down to meditate, all the monks, Ajahn Ganha in front of everyone else. And then after a while, they hear this noise. Yeah, and they're all sitting there with their eyes closed. They don't know what it is. Okay, forget about it. No problems. And the noise gets louder, yeah, and louder and louder, until eventually Ajahn Ganha feels that something is almost in his face. That's when he kind of, okay, I better maybe should open up my eyes and see what's going on. So he opens up his eyes, and when he opens up his eyes, what he sees is a king cobra, kind of like this, right? Almost looking him in the eye. And... that this is supposed to be one of the most scary things that can happen to you when you have an enormous snake like that staring you straight into the eye, looking as if it's about to strike you or something. It's very kind of frightening. But he is this incredibly cool monk, right? Completely cool. He is really cool, right? Really cool. It's a higher kind of coolness. Yeah. So what he does, because when you come to that stage, you don't have any fear anymore. Fear is gone. Why? Because you don't really care if you die or not. If you die, no big deal. You're going to kind of, there's no kind of suffering in the future anyway, so no big deal. So very slowly he takes up his hands up, right? Takes it out, because the snake is so close. He just puts his hand on the snake's head, pats it on the head. Oh, thank you, snake, for coming and visit us. Now is the time for you to move on. So the snake gets probably really confused. Right, what is going on here? This is not supposed to happen. So the snake just kind of humbly goes down on the ground and then goes off into the forest. But that is kind of one of those situations where the most people, you would get a heart attack or something like that, because it is so incredibly scary. And one of the monks, I met Ajahn last year, I met him before as well, one of the monks, the other monks in Bodhidharma Monastery, he went to Ajahn Gandha last year and he asked him about this story. Is it true? No, actually he didn't ask it's true. He asked, what happened to that snake? You know, what did the snake feel? And Ajahn Gandha said, oh, you better go off into the forest and ask the snake. That's the only way you're going to find out. But clearly it was a true story, right? That was kind of the outcome of that he was getting. So these are the kind of stories that make you feel that there is something going on sometimes that is kind of outside of ordinary human experience. And kind of, you know, it's really kind of astonishing here. And some of the other people that I find very inspiring are the people who stay by themselves for very long periods of time. And some of the monks that I know about in Sri Lanka, for example, because Sri Lanka, there's still so much jungle, even though they're doing their best to cut it down as quickly as possible now. But there is still quite a lot of jungle in Sri Lanka, and very beautiful forest. This is one of the things I find very inspiring about this Sri Lanka, all the beautiful forest and the jungle, all that. And then you have the huts way in the jungle somewhere here. Very, very nice and beautiful here. And there's a few monks who have lived in that jungle for almost their entire lives, like 30, 40 years. And then they come out of the jungle maybe once a year, and they have like a discussion with a group of monks, right? They come out, have a discussion about profound things like Nibbana, that kind of stuff. And then when the discussion is over, they just disappear into the jungle again, right? You don't see them for another year. And then they kind of come out like this ghost emerging from the jungle. And when they are in the jungle, they have these very simple, very, very simple kutis. Three-walled kutis very often. Because a three-walled kuti is like a cave. So the idea is to have a bit like a cave. And then you stay in that kuti. And then, of course, when you wake up in the morning, you often have an animal sleeping next to you. Yeah, so you have kind of a snake there sleeping next to you, whatever, when you wake up in the morning. Yeah. Because there's no walls. The animals just come in. And then you go off into the village to collect pindabat. And maybe you give a little teaching to the villagers. And then you go back to the kuti again. And that's the only human contact you have for 51 weeks of the year. That's all you ever do. And the rest, you just meditate. And what that tells you, very simple lifestyle, very simple requisite, what it tells you, the only way you can do that sort of thing is if you gain some happiness that is more profound, that is more than the normal happiness of human beings. There is no way you can live like that unless you gain that kind of happiness. So it gives you, when you think about it in the right way, it gives you this feeling that there is something going on in this world that is beyond the normal human experience, that is beyond what we normally can do. And these people, they are happy. They're actually more happy than most people just living in this way. And it kind of, whoa, it reminds you of something. Or, you know, like Ajahn Brahm, when he went on retreat, it's becoming many years ago now, but when he went on a six-month retreat, and after 6 months, he hadn't seen a single person for 6 months, nobody for 6 months. He couldn't really remember the names of the monks anymore. You know, who's that monk over there? I can't remember anymore. And he comes off retreat, and he couldn't speak anymore because his mind has completely stopped. There's no vitakka, vichara, no movement of the mind, so he could barely talk. He was kind of trying to... But he said, when he gave his first talk, he said, oh, 6 months of bliss, right? So he didn't really want to come off that retreat after 6 months. He'd be happy to just stay on because it was the most blissful experience of his life. And he could tell when he saw him, he was just utterly peaceful. He looked utterly blissed out, basically. So these are the kind of things that remind you of what is possible in this world. And it's not just the monks, there are nuns as well who have practiced really well in this way. People like Tenzin Palmo come to mind, who stayed in a cave, you know, in the Himalayas for 3 years or something, pretty much by herself. Or people like Ayakema, who was one of the pioneers among the Buddhist women, bhikkhunis. So both genders are capable, of course, of this kind of practice. And they are good. They are, you know, good. We have people who have done this thing before us that we can look up to in this way and see where the path is heading here. there are quite a few stories about that, astonishing, amazing stories about what people do in when they are. There's another story. This is a really interesting story. This is a very famous Chinese monk. His name was Empty Cloud, I think. I'm not sure what the Chinese characters are, but he was the master of another monk called Master Hua, who started this big monastery in California later on. But he lived in China, this Empty Cloud. And one of the stories, there's a book about him. I'm not sure how true these stories are, because I have no relationship with this monk. This is just what you read about. But one of the stories is that he was sitting somewhere, and his lay people would come and offer him some food, right? So they offered him some food and put it on the plate in front of him. And he said, oh, I'll just go into do some meditation first of all. So he goes into meditation, and then he emerges 7 days later, and the food is all gone moldy and everything when he comes out of meditation. So he has disappeared into meditation for 7 days. And if you go into meditation for 7 days, it is very, very profound, right? This is not some ordinary meditation. In fact, according to the suttas, the only way you can do that is if you attain the very, very highest stages of samadhi, even beyond the jhanas. Only then can you go into meditation for that long. So this is interesting. Sometimes people think that Buddhism in China is completely corrupt. But actually, we have to be very careful with these kind of statements, because they are very often, in every Buddhist country, you will find little pockets of people who still practice in the right way and who still gain the results of that path. And this particular Chinese monk seems to have been one of those who was able to practice the teachings properly, even though he was obviously probably influenced by Mahayana, even though it was probably very difficult in China because of the Cultural Revolution, all of these kind of things. They put a few spanners in the work. Still, people were able to do this. So there's inspiration everywhere where you look. If you look, know where to look, the inspiration is there. Okay. Oh, time is going fast as usual. So that's always a good sign. So let's do the last two reflections here. So actually, I didn't even say the rest of the parallel. I don't really have to say that, because it's exactly the same each time. So you gain the joy, right, when you think in this way. And when you gain the joy, it takes you all the way to samadhi. And when you get that samadhi, then you are in balance and you are unafflicted. Again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own virtuous behavior as unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to samadhi. And we have already looked at this sequence as well. We don't have to worry too much about it. So again, just this feeling, this knowledge that you are practicing well, you feel good about yourself, and then your joy arises as a consequence of that. When a noble disciple recollects his virtuous behavior, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by greed, ill will, and confusion. On that occasion his mind is simply straight, based on virtuous behavior. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the goal, in the where we are going, the atta, gains inspiration in the teaching, gains joy connected with the teaching. And then when he's joyful, he becomes rapturous. From rapture comes tranquility, and from tranquility comes pleasure, and from pleasure comes the samadhi, the stillness of the mind. And again, even based on that, you dwell in balance amid an unbalanced population, unafflicted amidst an unafflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of virtuous behavior. And then we have the last one. There is actually one more beyond this. The sixth one is actually a recollection of the devas, of the gods. But I've never heard of anyone using that, so I kind of left it out because it's a bit more specialized, perhaps. But anyway, the fifth one, again, Mahanama, a noble disciple recollects his own generosity thus. It is truly my good fortune and gain that in a population obsessed by the stain of miserliness, I dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of miserliness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. And this is beautiful the way it is put here, right? It is my good fortune and gain. You see everyone around you being slightly miserly, but you are not. And you think, wow, how fortunate I am that I am not obsessed by that miserliness. Sometimes if you are generous, you might kind of look down upon other people, say, yeah, they are just miserly. You know, how come they don't kind of, shouldn't they be more generous with whatever? But instead of thinking like that, you actually realize that miserliness actually is an oppression in the mind. It's a problem. So if other people are miserly, instead of kind of blaming them and saying they are bad people, you just rejoice in the fact that you haven't got that. The fact that you are generous, the fact that you understand the power of generosity. It's a beautiful way of looking at it, and it's a wonderful way of kind of thinking about these things in a good way. It's almost as if you have compassion for those people who are miserly here, and you kind of see, wow, I'm so lucky that I haven't got that. So it's just a very different way of looking at things than what we are used to. So you dwell at home, no stain of miserliness, like freely generous. Whenever there is an opportunity, whenever is a chance, whenever there's someone who needs something, you're always happy to kind of give and give and give. Open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. I'm sure many of you will know what is meant by this. Sometimes you just feel this powerful force of being generous inside of you. You want to give to everyone. It's like your mind kind of opens up, or your heart opens up to the world, and you just want to share, you just want to give. And there's kind of no limit almost. There's a limitless, bottomless a desire there to be sharing and giving to others. And it's a very beautiful quality if you can tap into that. It's very powerful. And you know straight away that this is a noble quality inside of you. That gives them the rise to the joy. It gives rise to this exactly the same sequence that we have been looking at before, all the way, taking you all the way to samadhi. So this is important. This is why generosity is such one of the foundations on the Buddhist path, because it leads, when you do it in the right way, it leads eventually to this feeling of freedom inside, the kind of freedom that is required, as you see here, to take you into samadhi itself. It actually says elsewhere in the sutta that unless your heart is open in that way and willing to always help and share and all these kind of things, if you haven't got that, you cannot enter the samadhi. You cannot become a stream enterer. You have to have that quality to actually become a stream enterer in the first place. And this is one of the ways of deciding whether somebody is an Aryan, a noble one. You know, because they are incredibly generous, always willing to give. You ask them something, they will almost always say yes, unless they are completely exhausted, or they just haven't got what you're asking for, or whatever. Yeah, so they have this natural willingness to give at all times. This is one of the qualities of the noble ones. So this is actually one way of assessing that. And then, as you do that, exactly the same thing happens again, right? When a noble disciple recollects their generosity on that occasion, their mind is not obsessed by greed, ill will, and confusion. On that occasion, their mind is simply straight, based on generosity. Chaga, this is all Chaga Nusati. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the goal, the meaning, the purpose, gains inspiration in the teaching, gains joy connected with the teaching. When he is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. When tranquil in body, feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes stilled. This is called the noble disciple who dwells in balance amid an unbalanced population, who dwells unafflicted amid an afflicted population. As one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma, he develops recollection of generosity. So there you are. These are the ways of developing joy on the path. And the way to use these things in practice is to use them in your meditation. And the best way is, first of all, when you start out in meditation, always start off by just finding that balance inside of yourself, allowing mindfulness to arise, finding making the present moment a pleasant moment. Sometimes you may not even be able to do that, and that's okay. We are all different places on the path. But that is what we try to do first of all. Just sit back and enjoy the present moment. Allow the mind to calm down, everything to become peaceful. And then when you have a degree of mindfulness, that is when you do these kind of recollections. And very often you don't have to do very much. You don't have to deliberately think, yeah, I did this, I did that kind of stuff. If you do too much of that, often it destroys the peace and it destroys the, you know, the joy of the occasion. Very often it's almost as if the mind goes there naturally. You know that you are living well, as I said before, you nudge your mind a little bit in that direction, yeah? A very tiny nudge, just to remind yourself of the sila nusati, the recollection of your character. You just think, yeah, I'm living a really good life. You don't have to kind of think anything in particular. You just know that in your heart. And that knowledge in your heart gives rise to the corresponding joy and then takes you to samadhi. Or with generosity, you just know that you are a generous person. You can feel it inside of you right there then perhaps, and you go with that. Sometimes, if you wish, you can also think about maybe specific instances of generosity when you did something, an instance that was very powerful and gave rise to lots of joy because for whatever reason it was. And then you can think of that specific instance as well. But don't try too hard. Kind of allow your mind to go there by itself, because you know that that is a wholesome place to go. And then you allow these things to come up. This is one of the great things about the Buddhist teaching. You know, we are encouraged to kind of reflect on the fact that we are living well and living a good life, not to kind of hold back on that. If that is done in a truthful and honest way, it's a very beautiful way of taking us forward in this way. Okay, so that is all for now. Tomorrow morning we will finish off the path all the way to the samadhis and everything else. I'm going to go back a little bit. There's going to be some interviews now. So I was thinking that if there's any one of you who would like to talk about anything, because there's only so many slots in these interviews. So if any one of you would have something you want to talk about, you are welcome to come after the last interview at 5 o'clock and have a quick chat if there's something you want to talk about. So please feel free to do that. I will hang around a little bit longer, just in case somebody has something that is important or whatever it is. Otherwise, we'll see you again this evening at 7:30 here.